This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 5th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Penguin Ed's Barbecue, now accepting Thanksgiving holiday orders for smoked turkey and ham through Sunday, November 18th. Trimmings and side items are also available, as well as catering and pickup orders. More information is available on the web at penguineds.com. Theater Square's annual Gala for Education, presenting the 2012 Arts Advocate Award to Denise and Hershey Garner, will take place Thursday, November 15th at 6:30 p.m. The event, co-chaired by Lucy Arnez and Lawrence Luckinbill, will benefit the theater's annual outreach to over 10,000 students and teachers. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org or 445-6333. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, we take a look at a remote area in Madison County that was once inhabited by Ozark African American settlers and their descendants. And we head to the set of Gordon Family Tree, a movie that was recently being filmed in Northwest Arkansas. Plus, the latest installment of Arkansongs. Ruby Brock brings us the latest business and political news from around the state and more. But first, a medical vending machine company is suing the Family Council Action Committee and Jerry Cox for using an image of one of its machines in a recent press conference. Cox, who was speaking against medical marijuana, used a cardboard model of the vending machine with a marijuana leaf added to the front of it to illustrate what he says would make marijuana too easily available. Cox wouldn't comment on the suit directly, but says he's surprised by it and that it doesn't change his efforts to oppose medical marijuana.
We're just forging ahead. Our lawyers are handling the lawsuit, and we're continuing to stay on message that this is just a backdoor effort to legalize marijuana. And otherwise, why would there be such a fuss about it from groups out of state?
Victor Medizidi is with Medbox Incorporated, the company whose image Cox used. He says Medbox needs to protect its image because Cox's characterization of its services was inaccurate. He says the company doesn't have a stance on medical marijuana, though that is one use for the machines.
It's all used inside dispensary locations, if it's a medical marijuana clinic, in order to control and police how the medicine is being distributed. And also the machine's used in a lot of other aspects as far as the healthcare industry, in urgent care centers for traditional medications, so that staff can be monitored.
A lawyer for the company says the outcome of Tuesday's vote will not affect the future of the lawsuit. New revenue numbers out Friday show that for October, Arkansas came in below forecast and below the same time last year. Gross revenue was $442 million. That's 2% lower than had been forecast and 3% lower than last year. John Shelnut is an economist with the Department of Finance and Administration.
I don't think this really impacts anything. I mean, we're still above forecast year to date. I think we'll see the numbers settle down some in the November results and maybe get a better look at what the underlying growth rates are for a number of these important revenue categories.
Shelnut blames weak sales and income tax collections for revenue being lower than expected. Drivers in Fayetteville who regularly use Ash Street between College Avenue and Old Wire Road during the daytime hours will have to adjust their routes for the next 2 months. According to a release by the city, the stretch of road will be closed between 8 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. from now through the beginning of January. The street will reopen to all traffic in the evenings and on weekends. With Veterans Day approaching, focus in the coming days will be placed on uniformed Americans and the services they perform for our country. Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe says while gratitude is shown when troops deploy and celebrations are held when they return, the quieter transition into domestic life can cause the greatest difficulties. With more and more veterans back home and looking for work, Beebe says many veterans are struggling to find employment. Beebe says it is a problem that officials in Arkansas have been working to solve during the past year.
Leaders of the Arkansas National Guard work within their ranks to seek out troubled soldiers and airmen, spreading the message that asking for help is a sign of strength, not weakness. State agencies like the Arkansas Department of Veterans Affairs and private groups like Our Vets provide easier access to locating employment, counseling, and other support for servicemen and women. Every year, businesses go the extra mile to ensure that Guard members can train and deploy and still have their jobs waiting when they return. These are the kinds of acts that bolster our words of support.
Governor Beebe's thoughts on Veterans Day came days after the state received a $1 million federal grant to expand and rehabilitate sections of the Arkansas State Veterans Cemetery in North Little Rock. The number of Arkansas residents voting early continues to climb. According to a release by Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin, more than 371,000 people voted as of 5 p.m. Friday. And with the election coming up tomorrow, today is the last day to early vote. Early polling ends at 4:30 this afternoon, and polls will be open from 7:30 tomorrow morning until 7:30 tomorrow evening. If you're still unsure of where you stand on the candidates or on the statewide ballot issues, there is still time to do your homework before heading to the polls. More information about what voters face on this year's ballot can be found online at the Arkansas Secretary of State's website at sos.arkansas.gov. Though construction may be a dirty word for many students, faculty, and other members of the campus community who have had to deal with daily detours, the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville has been honored for its ongoing development work. The Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce awarded the college the Albert M. Burns Developer of the Year Award for its work in not only building new facilities, but also in redesigning, repurposing, and redeveloping old and underused buildings. According to a news release from the college, 1.5 million gross square feet have been affected by development efforts since July of 2011. That translates into $480 million in construction and renovation of 40 buildings. Those projects will include more than 1,000 new classroom seats, 630 new residence hall beds, 250 dining hall seats, and a new 700-seat performing arts center. The Arkansas women's basketball team opened its season with an exhibition win yesterday at Bud Walton Arena. The Razorbacks defeated Rogers State 69-40. Arkansas forced 36 turnovers and held the Hillcats to a 29.8% shooting average. The women's basketball team will open the regular season against Jackson State at 11 a.m. Friday. The Razorback volleyball team saw little luck this weekend. The team fell to Auburn in five sets on Friday before losing to Texas A&M in four sets on Sunday. The Razorbacks' next match will be Sunday night against Kentucky at Barnhill Arena. Tonight, expect partly cloudy conditions with a low of 36 degrees in northwest Arkansas and a low of 46 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 57 in northwest Arkansas and a high of 64 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, expect partly cloudy skies, which will eventually clear with a low in the upper 30s.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. All of the eight metropolitan areas in or connected to Arkansas had jobless rate declines in September compared to August, and they were all down compared to September of 1 year ago. During September, the lowest metropolitan jobless rate was in northwest Arkansas at 4.9%, and the highest rate was 8.4% in the Memphis-West Memphis metro. The Northwest Arkansas metro area fell below 5% for the first time since November of 2008. And in Central Arkansas, the metro area jobless rate fell below 6% for the first time since December of 2008. In earnings news, El Dorado-based Murphy Oil saw its earnings fall to $226 million in the third quarter. That was a big drop-off from its $406 million quarterly profit 1 year ago. Lower natural gas prices and weaker margins were blamed for the declines. Murphy Oil is in the process of dividing its company into a pure-play exploration and production company and a separate refining and marketing business entity. Arkansas Best Corporation reported third-quarter profits of $6.5 million on rising revenue of $577 million. That was despite weakness in the economy, according to its CEO. 1 year ago, Arkansas Best posted a $12 million quarterly profit on revenue of $511 million. Falling revenue from weak demand and some one-time items doomed USA Truck's third-quarter profitability. The Van Buren-based trucking firm posted a third-quarter net loss of $6.4 million. That was a big uptick from 1 year ago when the company posted a $4.3 million quarterly loss. Metropolitan National Bank said it posted a third-quarter net loss of $1.24 million as the Little Rock-based bank continues trying to right its financial ship. 1 year ago, privately held Metropolitan recorded a $1.6 million loss. Metropolitan's been hit hard during the recession with a multitude of real estate deals and an aggressive expansion plan in northwest Arkansas that stretched the bank's resources thin. The bank has been under an order from federal bank regulators to improve its capital ratios, which it says it's doing. In less than 2 weeks, Governor Mike Beebe will present his balanced budget to the Arkansas General Assembly, but balancing a potential $400 million Medicaid shortfall will be a tough act. Beebe says he foresees two pots of money helping to shore up the Medicaid deficit, but it's not going to close the gap completely. He says that he will recommend an increase in general revenue, which is ongoing money, to help shore up Medicaid. He also says that he'll put some one-time money from the state's $145 million budget surplus towards closing that gap. Beebe also emphasized that he does not see a tax increase as a viable option to generate more Medicaid revenue. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
On Monday, conductor Lauren Mizell and the Vienna Philharmonic. Mizell says the Vienna Philharmonic has a unique sound.
They have a way of making music which is all their own. There's a warmth and an intelligence.
Lauren Mizell leads the Vienna Philharmonic in music by Wagner in concert at Carnegie Hall on Monday's Performance Today from APM.
Performance Today, tonight at 8 o'clock, following the evening edition of Ozarks at Large, here on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In Madison County, there's a place called Negro Mountain. It marks the remote area once inhabited by Ozark African American settlers and their 20th century descendants. All of them are gone now, except one individual. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to meet the last living African-American resident of Madison County.
It doesn't appear on the paper state highway maps, but if you MapQuest East Central Madison County, you'll see a tiny little triangle identified as Negro Mountain. Located on Horton Creek Township, it was home to a little-known Ozarks Black community. Some were descended from enslaved African-Americans who were first brought to Madison County in the 1830s. Their population grew to 300 by 1860, but after emancipation, half of them left. Families who stayed built homesteads, with most concentrated along Pigman Creek. Over the decades, their numbers dwindled to 124 in 1880, 44 in 1900, 15 by 1940. Today, only one descendant remains. All these records and much more are stored in the Madison County Historical Society in downtown Huntsville. And this afternoon, a special reunion is taking place to honor Madison County's historic Black population. Some white residents, like Wanda Evans, born in 1933, lived apart from the Blacks.
Their families lived on down farther down the creek. I'm sure my dad knew a lot more about them, but I just never did know them. And I was kind of afraid of them, you know, because I'd never seen colored people before. But they're just people like the rest of us.
Compared to other places in the South, she said, Black folk were accepted by Madison County white folk.
Pretty tolerant. Of course, there's intolerant people wherever you live. I think someone said that most people treated them pretty good, except there's one family or two that wasn't very nice to them. So,
but 80-year-old Vermily Johnson Inman, who still lives on Horton Creek, had African-American neighbors.
I'd see them go by. Sometimes they'd stop and get a drink at the spring. My folks had a good spring there. And they'd talk, you know, and they'd go on home.
When she was little, Vermalee befriended an older black girl.
We'd make mud pies, and the peach trees had bloomed, and the petals, the pink petals from the trees had fallen on the ground. So Artie said, let's put some of these pink petals on the pine. I thought that was the neatest thing I'd ever seen. just made that mud pie look so good.
The little girl was Artie Beatrice Cook, one of five children born to Haywood William Cook and Netsy Craven Cook. Now in her 90s, she still remembers those delicious-looking mud pies.
And put that on, like a coconut on top of a cake. Vermalee, you should knew I was going to be a cook then.
The girls grew up exploring the countryside and playing in the creek. Vermalee's remained in Madison County while Artie moved to Fayetteville and married John Funkhauser.
Artie Beatrice Cook Funkhauser.
Artie's retired now, having worked for many years at the University of Arkansas cooking in the fraternity houses, and she gets around just fine with help of family and a cane, which she occasionally taps to make a point. She's fit, sharp, and filled with stories, including one of the old homestead spring.
Everlasting water. It sure was.
It never went dry.
It's still, I was going to ask you, was it dry?
I'm not. You mean the spring?
Mm-hmm.
I never was up there this year, Artie.
It never did go dry.
Madison County's black children attended their own schools in the 1920s, Shady Grove and New Home. The Historical Society collections even holds a few of the black children's report cards. Among them is one of Artie's, who earned lots of A's and B's. To help pay for school clothes, Artie took a job with a local white family.
The thing about it, there was no work. When the factory shut down, there was no work. Okay. I hired out as a family. They wrote in the paper and they wanted some girl, you know, for school clothing, you know. And so the name was Dudgeons. And I wrote them the letter back and told them I would stay with them. You know, I would stay, you know, in with them. Okay, I would cook and, you know, do things like that and clean the house and do the laundry. And I did that and get money for my school clothing thing, see.
Eventually, all the black schoolhouses closed for lack of students. By the mid-1940s, only one black child remained in all of Madison County. And according to local history records, residents allowed the girl to enroll in an all-white school despite federally mandated segregation. No one objected. Some say the local school board and administrators kept it a secret from the State Board of Education. Artie says growing up in Madison County was like that. Everyone got along.
When we grew up, we could go to this show over here, and we could sit in the balcony, or we could sit downstairs. And this is the truth. Okay? We could go into the stores over here in Huntsville, and we could try clothes on just like we're doing now. And I mean, I didn't know any difference, honestly. Mm-hmm. And when I left and went to where I am now, I went in one time to try a dress on a Montgomery board. She said, oh, whoa, you can't try that on. I said, well, why? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to know your size. We don't allow people to try them on.
Well.
Now, that is the God's truth. And I don't have many witnesses left to tell the truth. It's true.
You grew up with a whole different experience.
I certainly did, but when I left, I said, what is this? Because I haven't been used to nothing like it.
Because where Artie was living then, in Fayetteville, like much of the South at the time, was strictly segregated. Mildred Stansel Jenkins, who is white, has deep roots in Madison County as far back as the early 19th century. And her family and the Cooks were close.
I knew the family. And her aunt, like I say, was always at my grandmother's house because we called her Aunt Mex, but she didn't have any kids. My grandma had seven, and they lived just across the creek. And I don't think Aunt Mex had a sewing machine, as I remember. My grandma used to sew for her, and she'd wash, help her wash. I mean, they just helped each other all the time. And I just grew up with her.
Mildred, who's moved away, reconnected with Artie after doing some family genealogy, and she's given Artie good perspective.
And so, I mean, you know, I've had a good life.
I really have. Now I'm kind of crippled up. But it's still good, and that I'm living.
You could be worse, couldn't you?
Now you can say that again.
On this beautiful warm autumn afternoon, Artie's being honored at a ceremony at Horton Creek Cemetery. A monument's been erected last January to commemorate Madison County's Black community. Joy Russell, president of the Madison County Historical Society, oversaw the project.
We took donations for several years here at Decoration, and then the Historical Society has money that we allot each year, and we paid the rest of it.
The large gray marble monument dwarfs Horton Creek Cemetery's gravestones. Among the estimated 20 or so African Americans buried here are Artie's two grandmothers, two brothers, her uncle, her aunt. Their names, along with the others, are inscribed on the monument.
I want to thank the people that got it together and really thought about doing something like it. And I appreciate it. I think it's very nice.
It's not real nice.
It really is. Yes.
See, your relatives are rejoicing.
Yeah.
And after a little while, Artie Beatrice Cook Funkhauser and her lifelong Madison County friends sing for each other, and all their loved ones laid to rest. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Hallelujah, by and by. I'll fly away.
How was that, Paul?
That's good.
It's Monday, November 5th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is the only night this week that isn't full.
Huh.
So I would suggest change out to your winter clothes, do the laundry, because we're going to need it the rest of the week.
Okay.
There's a Book Talk at Night book club meeting at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. Interesting choice of book, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
Huh.
Been a long time since I've talked about that one. Had nightmares from the movie for years.
Mm.
And auditions tonight for Ed McClure's script, A Christmas Carol Today, Second Chances.
Now, has he done an original script or an adapted script,
so.
Right?
I think this is his first fling. 7 o'clock tonight for the auditions at Rogers Little Theater. You can email him at enm@mcrmt.com, or you can call me when you didn't understand that.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
The presidential debates are over. The campaign buses are rolling through their last stops, and soon all those ads will finally go off the air. On November 6th, voters will decide on a president, a new Congress, a dozen governors, and countless ballot initiatives. I'm Audie Cornish. Tomorrow night, NPR News will have results and analysis with special coverage of election night from NPR News.
You can catch the special election coverage beginning at 8 o'clock tomorrow night here on KUAF 91.3 FM. The League of Women Voters of Washington County will host a legislative luncheon on November 12th at the Washington County Cooperative Extension Office. Current lawmakers and those newly elected will report on what's ahead for the session in 2013. Lunches are available, but not required for attendance. For more information, 927-9800. In an effort to help Northwest Arkansas Animal Shelters, the Northwest Arkansas Humane Society, and promote pet adoptions, Northwest Arkansas Community College will host an event November 7th from 8 to 4 on the NWACC campus. Some needed items include bleach, dry food for dogs, cats, and puppies and kittens, canned food for dogs, paper towels, and more. For more information, 501-766-5636 or send an email to rdawson1@nwacc.edu. The Community Services Clearinghouse is seeking sponsors to help provide Thanksgiving dinner to local families in need. The Clearinghouse Emergency Food Pantry assists elderly families, working families in crisis situations, and the families of low-income cancer patients. For more information on the Services Clearinghouse Thanksgiving Sponsorship Program, 479-782-5074. The Village Players will present The Philadelphia Story November 16th through the 18th at Northwest Arkansas Community College's White Auditorium. This is their adaptation of the 1939 comic play by Philip Barry. For tickets or more information, 479-876-1481.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
My baby's done left me, done said goodbye. She doesn't care if I live or die. I don't know what to do but sit here and cry, because my baby's done left me, done said goodbye.
In the early 1970s, Charlie Rich emerged on the American pop culture landscape as a country music superstar. But some of his fans then might have been surprised to learn Charlie Rich got his start as a rock and roller and dabbed in rhythm and blues and gospel and seemed most comfortable doing jazz. Rich was born in St. Francis County on December 14, 1932, and had been living in Saline County for years until his July 1995 death. This episode of Arkansongs focuses on the rock and roll side of Charlie Rich of Colt and Benton, Arkansas, and his time on Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, I live on macaroni and I stick up bologna just to see my little Donnelly. I'd swim the Mississippi River, nothing that I wouldn't give. I gotta see my little Donnelly. Donnelly, Donnelly, you'll never know what you do to me.
Charlie Rich attended Arkansas State on a football scholarship, served in the Air Force, and tried his hand at farming in West Memphis before trying music full time. Margaret Ann Green, his wife and high school sweetheart, and also a songwriter, was the instigator. Rich went to Sun Records in Memphis, the nearby city where he'd been already gigging most weekends. At Sun, they were impressed with the diverse talents of Charlie Rich. A little too impressed, in fact. Sun Records musical director Bill Justice said later he gave Rich a stack of Sun singles and told him to come back when he got that bad. But they knew they could use someone like Charlie Rich in the studio. Rich came on as a writer and session musician and dutifully attempted to simplify his piano licks and to steer his songwriting into the pop and rock fields of the late 1950s.
Standing at the station looking at the clock above. Left your baby, waiting for the train to take me to the one I love. Left your baby.
When Charlie Rich joined Sun Records in Memphis, his songs were supposed to be on the next single release of Sun's hottest performer, Jerry Lee Lewis. Then, the scandal of Lewis's marrying his 13-year-old cousin, while still already married, broke in the summer of 1958 in America following Lewis's ill-fated European tour. Sun hoped the scandal would blow over, but it didn't. With Johnny Cash leaving the label and Lewis becoming increasingly shunned, Sun needed another star performer. Rich ended up on the Sun subsidiary called Phillips International. Charlie Rich, who more seemed to have the personality of the session man and songwriter, made his debut in 1958. Philadelphia Baby, heard here, was aimed to please the local audience of the influential TV program American Bandstand, hosted by Dick Clark. It didn't chart, but a follow-up called Lonely Weekends hit the top 30. Sun Records head Sam Phillips acknowledged that Charlie Rich was the most musically adept performer he'd ever worked with. And, like with fellow Arkansasers Howlin' Wolf and Johnny Cash, his time at the Memphis label served as an incubator for his talent and commercial success yet to be fully realized. Heard here is one of many Charlie Rich original songs for Sun called Midnight Blues. Beyond Richard's eclectic musical talents not being quite focused, the label found it had a rather quiet and shy performer on its hands. And Rich's deep personality transferred to his performance. Compare and contrast the rock-era keyboard styles of complex Charlie Rich with, say, brash Jerry Lee Lewis.
Don't put no headstone on my grave. All my life I've been a slave.
Some of Charlie Rich's other Sun Records-era original songs, like the R&B-based Who Will the Next Fool Be? And the bluesy numbers Don't Put No Headstone on My Grave and There Won't Be Any More, showed the genius of Charlie Rich couldn't be confined to a single style. Though it would already be more than a decade before he adopted the nickname the Silver Fox, Charlie Rich already had his prematurely gray hair.
Just put me down and then move on. Just put me down and let me be free,
Christmas worry.
Charlie Rich stayed on with Sun Records until 1962. Rich's more R&B-tinged hit Mohair Sam was still ahead of him, as was recording for the labels RCA, Smash, and Memphis's High Records. It was on the Epic label in the late 1960s that Rich began his string of dozens of country music hits. It culminated with the international mega hits Behind Closed Doors and The Most Beautiful Girl. Rich's days as a would-be rocker were forgotten. But even with success, Charlie Rich had trouble playing the role, much like he had at Sun Records and basically Charlie Rich's complete musical career. Here in its entirety is Arkansas Your Charlie Rich of Colton Benton, with the somewhat jazzy piano version of the pivotal Memphis Sun Records rock and roll song Blue Suede Shoes, written by Carl Perkins of Jackson, Tennessee.
A one for the money, a two for the show, a three to make a red and I'll go, cat, go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Anything but don't stay off my blue suede shoes. Don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but play off of my blue suede shoes. The money, a two for the show, three to make a red and I'll go, cat, go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
Blue Suede Shoes, as interpreted by St. Francis County native Charlie Rich during his time at Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The process of watching a movie at the theater is fairly simple. Buy your ticket, select your snack of choice, sit in a seat, and enjoy the story as it plays out before you on the big screen. Making a movie is anything but simple.
All right, everybody quiet on the set. We're going to go ahead and roll this with one of our cameras. This is so complicated, we're just going to shoot everything. All right? Quiet on the set. Roll sound.
Rolling.
Roll camera.
Scene 16A, take one, speed.
Be careful, speed, smart.
Clear, be set. And action.
In September, the crew and cast of Gordon Family Tree were hard at work filming throughout Northwest Arkansas. On this overcast September day, the filming location is a home that's tucked away among the trees on West Pratt Drive in Fayetteville. Although it's located just a few minutes west of the hustle and bustle of the University of Arkansas campus, this home, which looks like an overgrown treehouse, feels like it's in the middle of the woods. Today, the owners have graciously given their home to the cast and crew of Gordon Family Tree, a project of Jenica and Ryan Schwartzman.
Jenica and I wrote it, and I grew up here, and my dad built this house. My dad's a builder here. He's a contractor building just custom homes, and which is one of the characters, is one of the main characters is based on him, a person in Arkansas who builds homes that the community knows and embraces. So we're using a lot of the homes that he built.
Ryan plays the lead in the film, which tells the story of a man who quits his job at an architecture firm and goes on a road trip he never took in college to really think about his future. One of the first things you notice being on a movie set is how many people there are. Between cast and crew, there are people everywhere working on hair, makeup, lighting, and cameras. With so many people working on such a large project, delegation is key.
Delegation's a big one, as well as making sure everyone just does their job, which is a big part of Mike Hill is our first AD, and his job on set as the first assistant director is to really make sure everyone is doing their job and their job alone. So making sure that the actors aren't moving equipment and making sure that the costume person isn't, you know, moving things, making sure that crew aren't moving props, because a lot of times when you're shooting in a location, you see just an empty cup or a couple flowers or a pillow even, and people just come up and think, oh, well, I should move this out of the way, but it's set there specifically for a reason.
For people that are new to a movie set, Ryan says one of the things they may notice is the use of some unique terminology.
There's a lot of odd things where things have different names that don't need different names. Like an extension cord is called a stinger. There's just odd terminology. A lot of times they use, like you'll see, there's clothespins on the lights that hold the gels and filters, and those are called C-47s. I can't tell you why, but it's what it is. And if someone is stepped away and they've gone to the restroom, then a lot of times they'll say, okay, where is so-and-so? And instead of saying they're in the bathroom and they're in the restroom, you say they're 10-1.
After spending just a little bit of time on set, it's easy to see that there is so much planning that must go into the project before filming can even begin. Ryan says some of the biggest details to attend to are scheduling and eating.
Food is a huge one that a lot of people forget about, just because you're, you know, everybody needs to eat and you're thinking about, oh, we got to get all the equipment, we got to get the actors, but you have to feed people. I mean, just to keep them happy, to keep energy there. So fortunately we've got, that took a lot of doing, that Jenica did, getting local restaurants have sponsored all of our meals, which has been amazing, to get them on board and donating their food for our meals. And let's see, what I mean, getting extras is a big thing. People who are willing to come out for free and, you know, give their time and energy and be high energy. And and then there's other little things, like when you're on set you have to print stuff, but you don't always have a printer, so we now have to carry a printer, and we have to carry like a portable internet thing so we can upload things. And there's a lot of little things that we keep learning, as well as, you know, remembering we need to do.
Yes, it's true, different shoots may require different things, but what is a typical day on set like?
A typical day is generally at least a 12-hour day. We, for example, this morning, the crew was called on set, so everyone had to be here at 8 a.m., so they have to, you know, account for their travel here. And then we always have 6 hours, and then there's lunch. So you have 6 hours, so you get here and you have to start working right away, 6 hours and lunch, and then you also account for 6 hours after that is dinner. So it's very different from a lot of jobs where, like you said, 9 to 5, you show up, you take a lunch break, and then you go home. But here it's, you show up and you don't think about food. Someone else's job, like ours, to make sure you're fed lunch and then you're fed dinner. And then after dinner, you usually work for maybe an hour or two, and then you'll go home. And there are rules and regulations for union jobs, but we're trying to abide by those as much as possible, just because they're in place for a reason. Such as at the end of the day, there's what they call a 10-hour turnaround, meaning that when the entire crew gets wrapped or gets to where they're staying, there needs to be 10 hours between that time and when they are called to set. So that, a lot of times, is another scheduling thing we have to deal with, where we can say, okay, tomorrow we're going to start at 8 a.m., but if the night before we don't get home until midnight, then we have to start later the next day.
Helping keep track of the time is a job of the first assistant director, who is known as the AD for short. Ryan explains that the time allotted to shoot a scene is based on the length of a scene or a fraction of a page.
We get a call sheet every day saying this is what time and this is what we're starting with, and then we're starting with scene 22 and then going to scene 41, and each one is broken up into an eighth of a page. So this is 1/8 page, this is one page, and you kind of work it out to figure out about 5 pages a day is a lot to shoot. So you can base it on how much dialogue there is, and so there's a lot of thought and energy that goes into that. But on set, the first AD's job, and Mike Hill has been amazing to us, because he is just, talking to him, it's just like numbers are flying in his head that I don't understand. Because we'll say, okay, we have, the director will decide how many shots he wants for each scene, and then the director will say, or Mike Hill will say, okay, if you have that many shots, that means you need to move you have this many setups, you need to move the camera every 8 minutes. And he's on top of it. He's got his watch, and he looks, and then he'll go and say, okay, well, you're behind schedule, so now in order to catch up, you need to move the camera. To get everything else, you need to move it every 5 minutes. So his job on set is, unfortunately, a lot of times the first AD's job is to not be liked. But he's a great guy. We all love him. He's great, but you have to be okay to be forceful and tell people, this is what has to happen. You need to move. You need to, because he's watching the time.
Okay. All right, everybody, now have your attention, please. This is scene 16. We need you to take good, careful stock of where you are right now in scene 16, because things are about to get a little complicated. What we're going to have in here is a toast going on by Mr. Gordon. So naturally, we would all turn to face him. So even if you're facing
the AD's job can also involve giving directions to the actors on set. Today, Mike Hill is directing more than a dozen extras who are filling the kitchen and living room in preparation of filming a birthday party scene. Tucked away in a narrow hallway near the front door, Nicole McAleese is sitting in front of a screen with a binder in her lap. I'm later told this area is called Video Village and is where the director and some other crew members like Nicole, the script supervisor, will huddle around the screen and observe as scenes are filmed.
My job is to make sure that we can cut the scenes together and that the editor has an appropriate, like, guidance system of how to find which scenes he wants next. Otherwise, you can hand him a roll of stuff, that it's all a mystery. So my job is to make sure that he can do his job.
Excellent. So how do you do that? Like, what you take? Is there a certain way to take notes or something?
Yeah. I take down the camera roll, and I take down what the slate has, and I also write down notes. Like, and I also make sure like the hair is the same. if you cut back and forth between two people talking and like bangs are on one side and bangs are on the other side, that's kind of a problem. I also help keep track of what we're shooting today and what needs to be shot.
What are you doing over there, Justin? That kind of looks good.
The phrase "hurry up and wait" is sometimes used to refer to the film industry because cast and crew rush to be ready and then have to wait on someone else to finish their job in order to proceed. For example, before the extras could be ushered into the room, they had to wait while a crew set up lighting. As Nicole sits by the monitor, several men in black shirts and jeans come check the screen before going back and making more adjustments to their lights. Part of their challenge today is making it appear like night, even though it is afternoon, albeit an overcast one. Nicole's brother-in-law, Ian, is one of the crew members moving light fixtures and placing different colored sheets on plastic over the tops of light bulbs.
I'm the gaffer, so the DP, the director of photography, is my boss, so he is in final call, final say of what everything looks for, but my job is to understand what light's going to do, and if he says, I want there to be a light in the background and have it slash down on this general area, I know what things to put in front of the light to shape it in order for it to do that.
Of course, before the actors can come onto set, they must be dressed, both the actors and the set. Darlene Hampson, Jenica's mother, spends most of the afternoon walking briskly back and forth despite wearing a large black medical boot. She says it's a prop that came in handy after spraining her ankle on set. She has several jobs and is in charge of wardrobe, props, and set dressing.
Set dressing is mainly what I do, and that's simply make the set ready for, so whatever color scheme we're using, or like turning the rolling pin to Mag's diner and making all the things that Mags would need to go with her character, like her name tags and her apron and all the things that give her distinction, and turn that particular restaurant into the restaurant that we're talking about that would be on the side of the road in Flagstaff, Arizona.
In addition to all of the tangible items, patience is a must on a movie set, especially because a director may have actors recite their lines again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick little something.
And again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick little something.
And again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick something. Some of you may have heard this a time or two, but...
In order to film a scene just the way he wants. Once the director does get what he wants and filming wraps on a project, writer and producer Ryan Schwartzman says the filmmaking process is not yet finished. The next step is all of the editing that happens in post-production.
Fortunately, our director really does a lot of the editing himself, which I think makes things go very smoothly because he sees what we're shooting. He has a visual idea of what he wants. So we are giving up probably 95% of control of editing to him, and then we will visit it throughout the process and look at it and watch, and if there's something that really jumps out at it that bothers us, then we'll let him know we want to tweak that. But for the most part, like I said, he's got about 95% or more control of, at that point, it's his movie. And that happens a lot with the writer, is you write it and then you have to let go, because the director will a lot of times do rewrites, just something that he thinks will work better, and that's, you just have to be okay with it and trust that we hired a director who has the same vision as we do.
Filming has wrapped, but you can keep up with the movie's post-production progress at GordonFamilyTreeTheMovie.com.
And all that we have, and all that we've been given. May all your todays be blessed.
Yes. Cut.
Got it.
All right, cut.
Perfect. Okay, we're going again.
From the time their son was three, John Schwartz, a national correspondent from the New York Times, and his wife, Jean Mixon, suspected their son was gay. Even though they supported him as he faced difficulties in school fitting in, as a teen, he attempted suicide. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them about their memoir, Oddly Normal. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight beginning at 6 here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 5th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, "While there is a lower class, I am in it." Eugene Debs, born Terre Haute, Indiana, 1855. He was a paint scraper on the railroad as a boy, joined the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, became editor of their national magazine. He went to prison for support of the Pullman strike of 1894, and he came out of prison a committed socialist, ran for president in 1900 on the socialist ticket. In 1908, he campaigned for president on the Red Special locomotive, got more than 1 million votes, and 9 years later, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for a speech during World War I in which he said, "The rich start the wars, the poor fight them." It was a crime to publicly oppose the American involvement in World War I under the Espionage Act. And for that, Eugene Debs was sent to prison in Atlanta. He got out on Christmas Day, 1921, and the warden of the prison opened every cell block and allowed more than 2,000 inmates to gather at the gates and wave goodbye to Eugene Debs. He walked through a gauntlet of prisoners and began to weep as the crowd roared. It was on this day in 1930, a Swedish newspaper reporter called up Sinclair Lewis on the telephone to tell him he'd won the Nobel Prize in literature. Lewis thought somebody was playing a practical joke on him. He was the first American to win the prize, and he wasn't sure he deserved it. And he used his Nobel lecture to talk about all the other writers that might have been chosen, Dreiser or Sherwood Anderson, O'Neill, Willa Cather. And it's the birthday of Thomas Flanagan, born in Greenwich, Connecticut, 1923. He was a professor of literature, and he wrote his first novel when he was 50 years old, a historical novel entitled The Year of the French. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Here's a poem for today by Kathy L. Polka, entitled "My Son Calls Me While I'm in Line at the Stop and Shop." And I freeze, transporting tea from the cart to the conveyor belt, mind racing to places he might need me as I answer my cell. But he's not calling for rescue from the scene of an accident, a highway wreck, or more natural disaster. Rather, calling as if I were only in the next room. Home early from school, he is wondering what's for dinner, and after being told, asks if I might make mashed potatoes instead of rice. I sigh a little yes, slightly annoyed at his casualness, but glad to be able to heed the call, reminded I'm the one who thinks of this accessibility as a way to keep the world at bay, able now to respond anywhere, yet burdened by availability. Born into this expanding, more connected universe, he can't imagine why anyone would want to be out of reach, my child, who wears new technology like a second skin, and for whom the whole world is an easy touch away and should be. A poem by Kathy L. Polka, My Son Calls Me While I'm in Line at the Stop and Shop, from her collection Miracle of the Wine, published by Grayson Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Goddard College, offering low-residency bachelor's and master's of fine arts degrees in creative writing. More at goddard.edu. And by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from NOARC in their NWA Human Resource Association's monthly meeting Thursday, November 8th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Springdale Holiday Inn. A panel of HR professionals will answer questions about legislative reforms and guidelines that affect all businesses. Registration is required. NOARK.org for more information. The Friends of the Fayetteville Public Library will host its semi-annual book sale November 10th from 9 a.m. to noon on the lower level of the library parking garage, and it's promised to be the largest sale yet. The Fayetteville Farmers Market wants to remind everyone that the market is open for two more Saturdays on November 10th and 17th on the square from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. There's a great selection of fall produce as well as meats, eggs, arts, crafts, and goodies and free parking in the town center garage. Special holiday markets will be held November 17th on the square and December 1st at the Botanical Garden. For more information, FayettevilleFarmersMarket.org. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Van Buren. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening and have a fantastic Monday.
If you could move